unemployment can be expected to further increase, and poverty and inequality are likely to follow the same path.
The blame for this rests with the European Commission. Some lawmakers insist.
Sont notre cauchemar.
Your policies are a nightmare. Unfair competition, public services destroyed, mass immigration, greater precarious employment, and poverty amongst young people. You think that you can cure the disease that you yourself nurtured.
The economic situation in the EU was wobbly prior to the pandemic. Now things are much worse. Citizens have been sharing their experiences.
I work less, and so I'm one less money too. And the other costs are still here.
The whole situation, the whole viral outbreak, has clearly consequences on all levels, on a social level, on a family level, and also on an economic level.
A 672 billion euro COVID-19 recovery fund has just been endorsed by EU lawmakers. However, some claim governments in the bloc will squander the money.
The Spanish government has increased the budget for the king and for the army, and has no plans for struggling businesses.
Apparently, to save the EU project from collapse, the 19-nation eurozone must be prioritised by governments.
We've been caught in with disaster for a long time. We have avoided disaster inside the eurozone, but there is no reason to believe that we'll continue doing so forever.
In the EU's richest country, Germany, 8 million workers are on very low pay. EU lawmakers are demanding a minimum wage for the 27-country bloc. The European Commission previously set a target to take 20 million people living in the bloc out of poverty before the end of 2020. That effort failed miserably. Many lawmakers argue the EU is not the solution, it's the problem. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The government of Venezuela is ramping up efforts to obtain coronavirus vaccines to inoculate its population, despite the ongoing economic crisis prompted by a series of tough U.S. sanctions. Although Venezuela has so far succeeded in keeping infections fairly low with regular lockdowns, the nation is still facing many challenges due to Washington's harsh restrictions. In this context, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza has slammed the rich countries in the Americas, namely the U.S. and Canada, for hoarding COVID-19 jabs. Arreaza remarked that this harmful policy is depriving other countries in the region of enough vaccines. He said this is a tantamount to putting political and commercial interests above human rights. Venezuelan officials back Arias's argument.
Venezuela will fight legally against the monopoly that the U.S. and its allies are purportedly trying to establish over COVID-19 vaccines.
However, some opposition members have a different opinion.
If the U.S. and Canada have more access to vaccines, it is because they are democratic countries and Venezuela is not.
But experts say that Venezuela is in fact a democratic nation and deserves free access to vaccines.
Venezuela has the same rights to the coronavirus shots as any other nation, since politics shouldn't meddle with humanitarian issues.
While the Maduro government works to guarantee a proper vaccination process for all the Venezuelans, it also has to deal with a round of U.S. sanctions that hinder the access to such vaccines in the region. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a sit-in in front of the Red Cross office to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights, including access to proper medical care during the coronavirus pandemic. Last month, Israeli regime forces arrested 456 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including women and minors. Hamas movement demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
Zionist practices against Palestinian prisoners violate all international laws and norms. We came here to express a united stance in solidarity with the prisoners. We call on all international organizations to intervene and protect Palestinian prisoners, especially during the coronavirus pandemic.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. The plight of Palestinian prisoners has increased amid the coronavirus pandemic. Around 400 of them have been infected with the deadly virus.
We call on the International Committee of the Red Cross to help Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. We are deeply concerned over the prisoners who suffer from medical negligence. More and more prisoners are infected with the coronavirus because of the overcrowding and lack of hygiene products.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians, who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Continuing the resistance is the key to liberate the prisoners, including by capturing Israeli soldiers to swap them with Palestinian inmates. We also need to increase solidarity activities to support the prisoners and highlight their suffering in Israeli prisons.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Currently, thousands of prisoners are kept inside Israeli jails, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The head of Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute says the Razi-CoV-PARS vaccine will be an excellent option as it is the first injectable inhaled COVID-19 vaccine of recombinant protein. Dr. Eli Sari, speaking at a press conference, said the vaccine produced by the Razi Institute of Iran does not contain any elements other than the ingredients required for the vaccine.
The 96 years experience of the Razi Institute is the backbone of the Razi-CoV-PARS vaccine production, and this vaccine must pass the relevant tests, and the media should assure the audience that the vaccine produced does not contain any negative side effects. Currently, Razi-CoV-PARS vaccine has been prepared for human injection, which will begin with the issuance of a license by the Food and Drug Administration of Iran.
The press conference came only one day after Iran unveiled its second domestically made vaccine titled Razi-CoV-PARS. Razi-CoV-PARS is administered in three stages, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart and an intranasal administration 30 days after the second jab. Developers say not only does this protect the recipient from the virus, but it prevents them from transmitting the virus to others. Those who receive the CoV-PARS vaccine will not need a mask anymore.
The country has the ability to produce all three types of the coronavirus vaccines, including those with the technology of African virus, inactivated virus, and mRNA. Razi-CoV-PARS is one of the safest vaccines with very few side effects, and it will stop the recipient from transmitting the virus to others.
Domestic rival Iran's first homegrown vaccine, CoV-1, is ahead in schedule and will start the second phase of the human trial next month. At the same time, Iran has imported the first batch of Russia's Sputnik V and will kickstart its mass vaccination this week. The first phase of the human trial of CoV-PARS will begin next week on 130 volunteers. Developers say the entire human trial will take some 5 months. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
After CoV-1 vaccine made headlines as the first viable Iranian-made vaccine for the coronavirus, another vaccine now grabs the spotlight, CoV-PARS. Developed by Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute, CoV-PARS is a protein-based vaccine. It employs recombinant versions of the spike protein, which tutors the immune system against the virus. This works with an adjuvant, a compound that puts frontline immune cells on battle alert to muster a robust immune response to the protein antigen.
This new vaccine works based on a recombinant spike protein. It's a proven method that has been around since 1980 and has been successfully tested on other diseases such as hepatitis. The first Iranian COVID vaccine used inactivated coronavirus, but this one works differently and can be injected or inhaled.
parts is administered in three stages. Two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and then intranasal administration 30 days after the second jab. Developers say not only does this protect the recipient from the virus, but it prevents them from transmitting the virus to others. Simply put, those who receive the COVPARS vaccine will not need a mask.
The first two doses give protection against the virus and strengthen the immune system against the coronavirus. The third dose, which is administered intranasally, will block the virus from entering the upper parts of the respiratory system. Therefore, the recipient will not exhale the virus and those around them will be safe.
The first phase of the human trial for COVPARS will start next week on 130 volunteers. Developers say the entire human trial stage will take 5 months. Its domestic rival, COVID-1, is ahead in schedule and will start the second phase of the human trial next month. At the same time, Iran has imported the first batch of Russia's Sputnik V and will kickstart its mass vaccination this week.
With COVPARS making its way to the human trial stage, COVID-1 now has a tough rival on its way toward the market. For now, Iran is a few months away from a marketable local vaccine, and until then, officials say Russia's Sputnik V will dominate Iran's inoculation program. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has held a national exhibition to showcase its latest scientific and technological achievements on the occasion of the 42nd victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. In this exhibition, 160 projects on such fields as healthcare, agriculture, defense, electronics, oil, and nanomaterials were unveiled. 90% of the proposed projects have reached production phase.
In chitosan, we process chitosan, which is a sugar that is obtained from the hard outer skeleton of shellfish like shrimp. Our company has processed chitosan at three grades which can be commercialized. Chitosan can be used in different fields like medicine, agriculture, textiles, and cosmetics, and etc. This will save the country hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Manufactured portable GPU or ground power unit, which is used to start the engines of light aircraft and helicopters. If you fully charge it one time, our GPU is capable of starting engines 9 times. This GPU can be used for devices which need high voltage.
Iran is a leading country in the region in terms of global innovation. According to the Global Innovation Index 2020 report, Iran ranks 26th worldwide for the share of its high-tech industries in the national production, surpassing the regional countries such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey.
At this exhibition, we are witnessing the emergence of new talents in our society. As you know, the enemies are trying to impose different forms of sanctions on our nation, but we have cut off the hands of dependence. We believe that sanction was one of the great historic opportunities for the Iranian nation throughout history. We have always stood on our own feet, and today the Iranian youth are moving the country on the path of independence.
According to the Scopus International Citation Database, the rate of scientific contributions of Iranian researchers to the world increased from 17% in 2011 to 31% in 2020, becoming the world's leading country in science diplomacy, with 14% growth.
In the past 42 years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in many fields, including science and technology. And now it has become one of the leading countries in scientific achievements in the world. Sana Kujuri, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
everyone. Welcome to the debate. 42 years ago, historic events sent shockwaves across the world. Iranians toppled a dictatorial monarchy and put in place an Islamic Republic. The revolution put an end to the domineering policies and exploitative practices of world powers in the country, on top of them, those of the U.S. Since its inception more than four decades ago, the Islamic Republic has been targeted by wars, conspiracies, assassinations, and unprecedented sanctions. The country has weathered the pressures and plots and even made great achievements, despite all odds, among them science and technology. And on top of that comes accomplishments in its military industry.
Iran's 1979 revolution had serious repercussions for the country's military. Following the establishment of the Islamic Republic, the US and the UK, two of the main military suppliers to the pre-revolution ruling monarchy, cancelled all previous arms deals and orders. The Pahlavi monarch's allies also took several other steps, including banning countries and companies from providing Iran with spare military parts or technical assistance to undermine the revolution. At the time, the Islamic Republic did not have to rebuild its defense capabilities entirely from scratch, but the Iraqi-imposed war changed everything. The lengthy war with Iraq proved that Iran needs to stand on its own two feet. While Saddam Hussein could get anything from top arms manufacturing countries, nobody was willing to even sell barbed wires to the Islamic Republic.
We went to one country after another begging for a single Scud missile to defend our people.
Tehran understood that the new strategy regarding its defense capabilities should be based on independence and self-reliance. The post-revolution Iran, through over four decades of existence, has greatly increased its defensive capabilities, such as maintaining and modernizing many of its weaponry and military equipment, as well as producing indigenous systems for its particular needs, with a strategic approach that has enabled it to remain a regional heavyweight. Air defense systems are an especially important component of Iran's military strategy. The country has domestically produced an advanced air defense system that utilizes mid-range, high-altitude, solid-fuel missiles. Buffeted by sanctions, the Iranian military now depends heavily on its ballistic and cruise missile programs. The Islamic Republic has state-of-the-art anti-access capabilities that can target military bases and aircraft carriers. Over the past decade, Iran has developed an array of domestic electronic warfare capabilities, including battlefield tactical communications equipment resistant to electronic warfare measures. It has also manufactured various command and control mechanisms, military satellite jammers, and a number of ciphering and deciphering systems. Iran's naval ability is mainly contingent upon ultra-fast speedboats and anti-ship cruise missiles meant to deter potential enemies in the Persian Gulf. The Islamic Republic has also developed short-range missiles that can be launched from a variety of naval platforms, including speedboats, to target enemy warships.
Well, lots of accomplishments made there. Let me now invite one of our guests to this debate. We'll have Director of the Risalat Strategic Studies, Sam Mehdi Torabi, from the Iranian city of Qom. Good to have you with us, Sam. Welcome to the debate show. As you know, Iran is celebrating the 42nd anniversary of its Islamic Revolution these days. What's the secret behind its flourishing cause, despite all the pressures by world powers, especially from the U.S.?
Actually, there's two points that explains why we've been able to survive, not only survive, but to flourish, as you said. Mm-hmm. The first point is that Iran's revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran is a religious project. It's a religious movement. It's a religious revolution. And a religious revolution in the sense that it believes in God and it believes that what it is doing is going and struggling on the way of God, in the way of God. So this is very important, and this is very different, and this is actually one of the things that at the time of the revolution was basically, we were told that God and religion have no more place in the managing of human societies. You were either a communist or you were a capitalist, and there was no third way, but we showed to the world that there is a third way or another way, which is the Islamic way and the religious way. So that's number one. And number two is that the revolution and the Islamic Republic is based on the will of its own people. The people conducted a revolution. It wasn't the army. It wasn't some, you know, vanguard elite, Leninist vanguard elite, some communist party. It wasn't some sort of a movement that was run by elites who just, you know, replaced one ruler for the other. It was a popular revolution that the people themselves conducted, as they also conducted the war. It was a popular movement. The people changed the regime. The people established the Islamic Republic of Iran. And to this day, the reason why we are able to survive is because it is the only country in this region, and maybe one of the few countries in the world, where the system and the governance of the country is based on the will of the people.
Right. Sam, Iran has left behind many crises and conspiracies since the victory of its revolution in 1979. One major chapter in the history of post-revolution Iran is the invasion of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. And he was aided and abetted, as you know, by the U.S. and its allies. And that war made Iran even stronger. Let's have your opinion on that and the effect of that war on the Islamic Republic.
Well, actually, Behrouz, I was in the city of Najafabad, in the province of Isfahan. And as you know, it is the city in Iran with the highest per capita
number of martyrs.
Amount of martyrs.
Exactly.
In relation to the population. And the people there, the Hausa in Najafabad, was kind enough to invite me today to have a meeting with the clergy, with the seminarians, and with some of the families of the martyrs. And so, you know, it's about sacrificing. It's actually not, you know, a very strange thing. When your country is attacked, you have to defend it, and the Iranian people defended it. And they sacrificed the best people that they had, the youngest, the young, who had all the hopes for a future, who might have been able to emigrate to other countries, who might have decided that they're not going to get involved in these affairs because of their own personal desires. But all of that didn't matter. The youth at that time rose up, went to the front, and defended its country, and defended the country, and defended the revolution, and defended the democracy that we had established. And this is why we were able to defeat them during the war. And it's still the same thing today. If you look at what happened in Syria, the war in Syria, and again, to go back to Najafabad, we have Shahid Hojadi from Najafabad, who was the young father who, you know, at the maybe the sweetest time of his life, where he was newlywed and he had a young baby, he decided to go to Syria and to fight Daesh and to prevent Daesh from taking over Syria and Iraq and then eventually trying to take over Iran. And, you know, famously he was beheaded. And in that video that Daesh made, in that cruel video that they made, he showed all the courage and all the faith and the deep belief that we have as Iranians, and he became a symbol of that. And so this is the reason why we were able to survive all these things.
Okay.
From that time, from the beginning of the revolution until today.
Sure. Now, joining us on the phone from the Answer Coalition, we also have Richard Vicker out of San Francisco. Good to have you with us, Richard. Welcome to the show. As you know, Iran has been an independent country since the Islamic Revolution, no more a satellite country of the United States. Is this fact not a thorn in Washington's flesh?
Well, thank you, and yes, certainly it is. The United States invested a great deal of money and military power and economic power in, and of course, in the intelligence operation in 1953 that overthrew the first democratically elected government, and really did create the conditions that for Iran to become a puppet of the United States, a source of great, great enrichment for the oil companies and the banks and the military industrial corporations in the United States, but at the cost of incredible suffering for the Iranian people. the widespread use of torture by the Sabak between 1953 and 1979, it took the lives of tens of thousands of mostly young Iranians. And, it was a terrible disaster for Iran. And the revolution restored Iran's independence as a country and has been viewed ever since, not based on any of the things that they talk about democracy or Iran developing weapons, but just that Iran escaped from the clutches of U.S. imperialism mm-hmm. has never been forgiven in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Richard, let me ask you a second question because you joined us a little bit late, and go back to Sam. In 2018, Richard, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton promised the MEK terrorist group a regime change in Iran by the end of 2018. He promised that Iran won't be celebrating the 40th anniversary of its revolution. So what kept that pipe dream from realizing?
Well, that's Bolton, you know, and you know, John Bolton, in addition to that statement, a few years ago he was asked, what's your policy on North Korea? And his response was, no North Korea. Mm. In other words, it would be eliminated as a country. It would be wiped off the face of the earth or you know, subjugated. And that's Bolton, but Bolton's been wrong. He was wrong about Iran. He's wrong about Korea. His ultra hostilities, ultra aggressive foreign policy advocacy has not borne fruit for the United States. It's caused a lot of suffering, again, for people around the world, the sanctions, the assassinations, and so forth. We know about that, but, you know, that's Bolton, and Bolton, you know, really stands against the forward march of history.
Yeah, maybe also the like of them, like Pompeo and some others. And let's go back to the city of Rome bring in Sam. Let's have your opinion as regards the root cause of Washington's hostile policy towards Iran, irrespective of which party is in power.
Yeah, the root cause is a strategic one, which is that ever since the British Empire was the first empire, a truly global and planetary empire. Since the time of the British Empire, the British strategists, and then later the Americans, who were the inheritors of the British Empire, determined that in order to rule the world, this is their own words, I'm not making it up, mm-hmm. in order to rule the world and to command the world, you need to control West Asia, Eastern Mediterranean, and West Asia. And Iran is at the heart of West Asia. In fact, if you want to, you know, summarize what West Asia is, it's actually Iran. And so basically, for them, it doesn't matter you know, who's ruling in Iran and who's ruling in America. In order to be able to be the global hegemon, they have to rule West Asia, which means they have to rule Iran. The last time this was clearly stated was in an article by Charles Freeman in the 2016 elections in the American Conservative, when Trump was talking about, you know, maybe leaving the Middle East, and as they call it the Middle East, we call it West Asia, mm-hmm. And leaving Saudi Arabia and all that, he wrote a very long article talking about if we abandon the Middle East, if the Americans leave the Middle East, then they have to abandon any sort of pretense of ruling the world. And the reason for that is because West Asia is the ultimate crossroads in the world. Anyone who wants to go from east to west, from north to south, has to pass through here. And it's not just about the fact that the Americans or the British could be able to transport their ships or their military or their airplanes or the land routes through here. It's what is called, and what Charles Freeman in the article called strategic denial of West Asia to any potential rival, any global rival. We saw that during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, the Truman Doctrine regarding the Eastern Mediterranean, which obviously includes part of the Middle East, and then later the Eisenhower Doctrine, and then later on the Carter Doctrine. So the point is that for the American elites, who are the inheritors of the British Empire, and in a way are continuing that empire, but in a different form, they have determined that it is their vital interest, and they will never let go. The beautiful thing in Iran is that we took away the heart of West Asia out of the hands of the Americans 42 years ago, and that's why they are continuing to bother us, and they will continue to bother us. And the only solution is we kick out the Americans out of West Asia, as was the declared policy by the Islamic Republic following the assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani, as so declared by the leader of the Islamic Revolution and the National Security Council, and this is going to happen, and Iran will take its place as the natural hegemon of West Asia. And after that happens, and when these fake regimes in these southern Persian Gulf states, and when the fake apartheid Zionist entity do not exist, when that is transformed to a Palestinian republic where everybody has equal rights, and when these Arab dictatorships, these medieval monarchies, are democracies, then we will have peace and prosperity in the region with Iran as the natural hegemon of the region.
Now, Richard, different administrations of the White House kept imposing sanctions on top of sanctions against Iran. The first U.S. sanctions, of course, were imposed when Jimmy Carter was president. Now, that trend reached its apex during the Trump era when the so-called maximum pressure campaign was launched, and putting, in American officials' own words, the toughest sanctions ever on Tehran. Now, given this hostile attitude, is it possible for this profound distrust to vanish?
Well, it can only vanish with an end to these policies. And, you know, we're hearing from Biden and Blinken yesterday and today talking tough about Iran. You know, that no, the sanctions won't be lifted before the there's a return of the U.S. and to the table with Iran under the JCPOA. You know, this just continues. So, and I think we have to see, as your other guest was referring to, the history, and to remember, you know, what was done to Iran. And the British Empire, as you mentioned, the British Empire ran its navy, which was the key to the whole empire, off Iranian oil after Churchill converted from coal to oil, a little over 100 years ago. So it was called Anglo-Persian and then Anglo-Iranian, and, you know, today, of course, it's known as BP, and it's not there anymore. But the suffering of the Iranian people who worked in the oil fields was just indescribable, but that ran the empire. And this is something that the story that's not told in the United States to the people of the United States, the real history and who was the aggressor and who was the victim of colonialism and what a profound impact that it had. But, you know, to see a change in this is going to require the people in the United States take action against the policies of the government of the United States, which, as was said earlier, continue under both Democrats as well as Republicans.
Right. Sam, Tehran has managed to boost its military prowess greatly in all that in the presence of unprecedented sanctions and pressure. The country is arguing that it needs to be strong militarily, given all that has gone through since the early days of the Islamic Revolution, i.e. foreign-backed sabotage and assassination operations, military aggression, espionage, incursions, coup d'etat conspiracies, and you name it. Let's have your comments.
Yeah, well, actually, it's called strategic deterrence, which is something, you know, anybody that has a rational thought and doesn't have some sort of a problem with rational thinking does for their country. They create strategic deterrence. Now, we've done this on a regional level. So, for example, the Israelis or the Saudis know that if they attack Iran, they won't exist 5 minutes later. And so this has...
Well, unfortunately, we've lost contact with Sam. So from on the phone, let's bring Richard Becker. Richard, Iran has turned into a major player in West Asia region. One instance is reaching out to Iraqis and helping them defeat Daesh on their soil. And conversely, the U.S. in Trump's wars created Daesh, which wreaked havoc across the planet. Still, Washington's blaming Iran for playing a destabilizing role in the region. On what basis do they make such a claim?
Well, I think it's really it's really clear that Iran played the key role in the defeat of Daesh, and of course it isn't gone altogether, and in defending the Syrian government against what looked better, if we remember back in 2011, 2012, when all of these major powers and others got together, it looked like they would, you know, they would crush Syria, which is, you know, the key country in the region. So, that's the reality of the situation, and it's not going to be the American government that decide, you know, to let this happen, to for Iran to be a regional power. And of course, Iran is there. Iran is in the region. It's the largest country in the region, in West Asia, along with Turkey. And it's, you know, it's not going anywhere, and it's not going to be overthrown. I think that there's an illusion, and it keeps being the hope of the U.S. government, whether it was Trump or, you know, Biden wants regime change too. That's really what they want, and they want regime change in China, and they want regime change in all the countries that take an independent stand and don't bow to the dictates of Washington.
All right. Okay, and then we come to the end of this debate show. Thanking my guests, we had Director of the Risalat Strategic Studies, Sam Matthew Tarabi, from the Iranian City of Rome, and also on the phone we had from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, who joined us from San Francisco. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafian. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
A geochemical study of sediments suggests that during recent glacial periods, the Arctic Ocean was completely isolated from the world ocean, with fresh water filling the basin for thousands of years. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Sharon Hoffman, researcher. This article is published under the heading, "The Arctic Ocean Might Have Been Filled with Fresh Water During Ice Ages." Stay tuned for the details, please. The Arctic region is undergoing rapid climatic and environmental change, so knowledge of its past variability is crucial for understanding modern trends and predicting future ones. Ancient climate conditions and ocean behavior are often reconstructed by analyzing marine sediments, but Arctic sediments can be difficult to interpret, and much is still unknown about how the Arctic Ocean changed during specific glacial and interglacial periods over the past few million years. Writing in Nature, Gubert et al. Report analysis of an isotope of element thorium in sea floor sediments, which suggests that the Arctic Ocean swung between being filled with salt water and fresh water during periods of the two most recent glacials. The authors base their argument on records of thorium 230 produced from the decay of dissolved uranium that is naturally present in seawater. Thorium is highly insoluble and sticks to solid particles such as dust grains or biological material, which sink to the seafloor and become buried in sediments. Thorium that derives from water column in this way is known as excess thorium-230. It is typically present in sediments deposited during the past 450,000 years and is often measured to determine sediment deposition rates. Gilbert and colleagues' innovation is instead to use these measurements to reconstruct how much thorium-230 was produced in the Arctic Ocean over the time, and thereby to determine how the salinity has changed. The authors examined sediment cores from across the Arctic and Nordic seas and found that thorium-230 is absent in several layers of sediment deposited during the past 200,000 years. The core suggests that no thorium-230 was produced in the water above the study sites between about 150,000 and 131,000 years ago, during the next to the last glacial. 70,000 and 62,000 years ago, during early parts of the last glacial, and perhaps even as recently as about 15,000 years ago, at the end of the last glacial. Thorium-230 produced in seawater is removed so rapidly by sinking particles that its net horizontal transport across the ocean is typically low, even in the particle-poor Arctic. The intervals of absent thorium-230 in the sediment cores therefore imply that the uranium concentration was low to non-existent in the water above the study sites when those sediments were deposited. This in turn implies that the entire water column was essentially fresh down to the seafloor. There were no dissolved salts of any type. Thick ice shelves covered regions of the Arctic during previous glacials. Gilbert et al. Posit that such ice shelves could have extended into the Nordic seas, possibly grounding on the Greenland-Scotland Ridge, the tall underwater feature that separates the Nordic Seas from the rest of the Atlantic Basin. The ice shelves might, in effect, have dammed the Arctic and Nordic Seas, isolating them from salty inflows from the Atlantic. The low sea levels at that time blocked the exchange of water with the Pacific Ocean through the Bering Strait. Fresh water from the melting land ice and precipitation could therefore have entered and eventually filled the isolated northern basins. An advantage of Gilbert and co-workers' thorium-230 method is that, unlike many other techniques used in paleoceanography, no biologically produced material is needed for the analysis. It can therefore be used to probe environments that would have had low to no biological productivity, such as a freshwater Arctic Ocean beneath ice shelves. Indeed, microfossils in the thorium-230 free sediment layers are absent or extremely rare, or are derived from older deposits rather than being contemporaneous with the thorium-230 minima. Thank you. this new interpretation of thorium-230 might also provide an intriguing means of reconciling contrasting results previously obtained from different methods of estimating past sea levels. The relative abundances of oxygen isotopes in global seawaters are recorded in microfossils and in part reflect the sequestration of evaporated ocean water into ice sheets or other freshwater reservoirs, which can affect sea level. For certain times, during recent ice ages, sea level records obtained from isotopic analyses of microfossils are inconsistent with records derived from corals. Gilbert et al. Suggests that these inconsistencies could be explained by the proposed storage of large volumes of fresh water in the Arctic Ocean. Various complications in the analysis will no doubt raise questions. Arctic sediments are notoriously hard to date owing to the lack of microfossils and because sedimentation rates varied. It is therefore uncertain whether the thorium-230 deficient intervals in the cores were produced at exactly the same times at all sites across the ocean basins. Moreover, the authors had to correct their data to account for 230 that was produced from uranium decay in sediment grains rather than in the water columns, and this contributed to the uncertainty in measured thorium-230. These corrections become proportionally more important for older sediments because thorium-230 itself decays away. Thorium decay also limits the time span over which the method can be used to investigate Arctic salinity. Finally, no freshwater fauna have been identified in the sediments concerned, so direct evidence of freshwater intrusion into deep Arctic basins remains to be found. However, the various absences of thorium-230 of microfossils and biological productivity and of elements such as sulfur, which partly derive from salinity in marine sediments, suggest exciting avenues for future research. Computational modeling of Arctic Ocean circulation and ice sheet behavior will be needed to determine realistic estimates of the circulation and freshwater runoff from land that could produce a basin filled with fresh water. Further geochemical and fossil analysis might help to support or challenge the assertion that the Arctic Ocean could have been fresh. Gilbert and colleagues' innovative use of thorium-230 might spare a re-evaluation of what is possible in the Arctic Ocean and of how dramatically this region can change.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.